Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, and you're listening to a special Thursday edition of the NewsCap podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode. It's only Thursday, but yet, it is time for the NewsCap. We'll talk DACA at the Supreme Court, public impeachment hearings, just a couple of topics we'll discuss with our guests, former congressional staffer Roy Herrera and Matthew Benson, partner at Veritas and former gubernatorial communications director. Guys, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Roy, let's start with DACA. I don't want to get too much into what was being argued because that's really more about executive action, what presidents can do. But how impactful do you think it was, even just the event of this, the fact that SCOTUS is taking up DACA?
Well, it was impactful, greatly impactful, I think. I mean, we saw the DACA recipients come out of the Supreme Court in solidarity. You know, I think what's important about this case, unlike a lot of cases that go to the Supreme Court, is this sort of the human, cost that could potentially happen as a result of an adverse ruling to DACA. I mean, we're talking about thousands upon thousands of people who live here, who've lived here most of their lives, who are embedded in the fabric of our country, both culturally and economically. And if the case goes against DACA and President Trump's allowed to rescind the program, this could result in human tragedy. And so seeing, you know, the people come together at the court, I think, was really important. I mean, I don't want to get into the weeds either, but it seems as though, just judging from the argument, that it didn't go particularly well for people who wanted to uphold the program. But I guess we'll see when it comes out, when the ruling comes out next year.
Now, Matt, before we get to some of those issues, this has been one that most Democrats, most Republicans at least have said nice things about DACA recipients, maybe from an economic standpoint, maybe from a humanitarian aspect. What do you make of how difficult this is to settle at some point?
Well, you're absolutely right that this population of dreamers is the most sympathetic group. We're talking about people who were brought to this country as children, young children in many cases. And so I think there is on the left and right, there's a desire to see them be allowed to stay in this country and contribute productively to society. But they are wrapped up in a much larger, much more complicated question about border security and illegal immigration generally in this country, and that's the reason this hasn't been resolved. You've seen President Trump has attempted to leverage this group in order to get funding for his border wall and other things that he wants to do on the border security side. And Democrats haven't been willing to play ball on that. And so here we are. That is the impasse, which I frankly don't see breaking anytime soon.
Does this push, if it goes the way you're saying it might go, Roy, like, does this push the pressure back to Congress to try to come up with some kind of deal again, even though, as you say, Matt, it seems a little unlikely at this point?
I mean, that's the hope, of course, that this would go back to Congress and then there would be a resolution to this. I think Matt is right in that, you know, how we resolve this has been caught up in the larger sort of immigration reform conversation. I think the perspective from a lot of Democrats, though, is that this group of individuals who are, again, you know, in my view, as American as you and I, shouldn't be part of the political football that necessarily exists in the immigration reform debate. And so if we can all agree on the Republican side and the Democratic side that they deserve, to have status here, to be documented here, perhaps have a path to citizenship here, certainly I believe that, then why don't we just fix that problem? But of course, you have the wild card of President Trump, where it's a little unclear, at least to me, judging from his tweets, you know, where exactly he stands on this. Because on the one hand, you know, he says things that are very negative about the DACA program, but then on the other hand, he seems to express some sympathy for the recipients. So I just don't know exactly, does he want to get something done or not? Unfortunately, given the election next year, I think it's going to be very difficult for there to be a larger bargain.
And Matt, you mentioned the border wall. So how much of this really does come down to either an unwillingness to challenge President Trump or the goal, at least among some Republicans, is to help him keep a campaign promise? And how much does that cause the political waters to muddy?
Well, the political waters are muddy all around. I mean, my friend Roy mentions that the president may not necessarily want to solve this issue for political reasons. I would suggest that Democrats have a lot of reason not to solve this issue either because they like to have this immigration question out there and to have the issues about the Dreamers, it politically is beneficial to the Democratic Party. And so I think that there's a lot of reason. I mean, look, Democrats had an opportunity to deal with this issue during the Obama administration when they had both the White House, the House, and the Senate. And the president chose to use that period of time to do health care instead of immigration. That was a choice. And so I think there's a lot of question. I think part of the reason this issue has gone unresolved for 20, 30 years is because there's reasons for both parties to not solve it. And here we are.
Let's talk about the Republican end of that, though. Also, like, will there be a backlash, you think, for Republicans if this goes, if DACA is taken away and you have, you know, 27,000 here in Arizona and hundreds of thousands of these upstanding citizens around the country in a position where they may be deported?
Yeah, I think the ramifications are enormous. You're talking about 700,000 DACA recipients nationally, tens of thousands in Arizona. And so politically, the ramifications of that, assuming, look, if we all are correct in reading the tea leaves here and the court is going to likely strike down the DACA program, then the political ramifications of that, assuming we get a ruling, you know, coming up here in the spring, going into an election year, it's enormous. And I think it's going to have huge ramifications, especially for Congress, which ultimately has responsibility here, and then obviously the race for the White House.
Well, I mean, you know, I want to agree and disagree with something my friend Matt said here. I do agree that there was a failure during the Obama era to address this problem. I mean, this is a time when I was actually working on the Hill myself, and Democrats chose not to do comprehensive immigration reform, and I really do think that was a failure. However, I do not think that the Democratic view would be that we benefit in some way by not having a resolution to this issue. I mean, I think, you know, the Democrats in the House at least have passed the DREAM Act already and have been waiting, you know, for action from the Senate and from the president. And so I think if you put a clean DREAM Act bill in front of any Democrat, they would do that immediately. That said, of course, this is a subset of a larger immigration debate. I think certainly Democrats believe in border security while also providing a very humanitarian view on what immigration and migration looks like, as well as a path to citizenship for certain individuals that are here. That has to be part of a larger debate. But when we're talking about Dreamers and DACA recipients, I just don't see why that needs to be included.
The word nuance for me, though, Matt, even though John Kerry used it and so people don't want to hear it anymore, it's a word that is tougher these days, isn't it? Because I think both of you are making very interesting points in that it can benefit one party over the other, or border security is seen as more of a Republican issue. Are we to a point, though, where each side has to be so in their camp that it's even hard not to compromise, but even to discuss compromise?
I think that both sides have become much more hardened on their views of this issue. Look, I'm old enough to remember when Democrats, Roy pointed out, well, as Democrats, we support border security. I mean, Democratic union members especially supported border security for employment issues. But I'm not so sure that's where the Democratic Party is anymore. During these presidential debates, the candidates, the Democratic candidates running for that office have said almost without exception they support decriminalizing crossing the border illegally. So, and you know, we've seen abolish ICE and things of that sort become a much more significant part of the Democratic platform. So I think that's part of the reason. Look, we can talk about Republicans being extremists on border security all we want, but let's not forget the Democrats have moved significantly to the left on this issue.
I want to also ask about the kind of economic implications of this. There's such an economic impact in potentially deporting or removing this many people who are, you know, working citizens in the country or residents in the country right now from the country. Does that sort of have political ramifications as well? Are you going to see business groups who might normally come down on the right side of the aisle come down in the middle or on the left on this, say, we don't want to get rid of these people?
I mean, I think we've seen that. We've seen a lot of the chambers of commerce, you know, certainly the U.S. chamber and local chambers be supportive of a resolution of this that allows DACA recipients to stay, I think primarily for humanitarian reasons, but also primarily for economic reasons, because, again, they are, as I mentioned earlier, part of the fabric of our economy. Again, people who have lived here most of their lives, anywhere from, you know, teachers to doctors to lawyers to construction workers to, I mean, they're part of, essential part of our economy. And to somehow remove them from this country is not only, you know, immoral in my view, but also would be damaging to the country. And I think the business leaders recognize that. And that's one of the few areas where I think you see progressive folks who are not, you know, business leaders, and business leaders agree.
And Matt, before the break, we're going to have a decision presumably in the spring by the Supreme Court if, in fact, they do strike down this particular program. In an election year, we're not going to see any activity. But does it become an important issue in the presidential campaign next fall?
It absolutely becomes a massive issue in the presidential campaign. Now, One of the wild cards here is, okay, let's say the Supreme Court strikes it down. That does not necessarily mean that the Trump administration moves immediately to begin deporting. Okay, the DACA program was about giving them the ability to work, to stay in this country and to work in this country. So it is possible the program gets struck down and really nothing happens in the short term. Maybe they stay, they continue to work. You know, there's a question, an open question about their work visas, driver's licenses, things of that sort. We don't know. But nothing says they have to begin immediately moving to deport. And I think that's the wild card here.
Briefly comment, Ray?
Well, I wish I could believe that. In other words, that there would be, you know, even if there's a bad ruling that somehow this would, you know, result in sort of non-action by the government. But I think what we've seen from ICE and what we've seen from Border Patrol in other contexts here under the Trump administration has been a very harsh view on how we treat people who don't have documentation and status here. And so it wouldn't surprise me, I guess, if I'm predicting what's going to happen, that actually Trump and the Trump administration goes the complete other way and actually does start doing things that I think most Americans probably wouldn't agree with, which would include removing people.
All right, that's Roy Herrera. Also here is Matthew Benson with Lauren Gilger in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein in the midst of our newscap, which continues after this. Back with the newscap here on KJZZ with Lauren Gilger in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our guest today, Matthew Benson of Veritas and former congressional staffer Roy Herrera. Matt, let's get initial reactions to the first public impeachment hearings yesterday. There was criticism we saw on social media. I don't know how much we can take from that. That the Republican prosecutor who was asking questions may have had a strange line, or they were attacking great Americans, great patriots. I guess this is such a partisan issue at this point. What were your observations generally from yesterday?
Look, it's a bad day for the president any time that we're talking about the phone call and you know, quid pro quo and bribery and the rest of it. But look, I'm not going to draw any conclusions based on one day of hearing. I think that is remains an open question. I don't think I think the takeaway here is going to be I'm looking at those 31 House Democrats who are in districts that Trump won, in many cases won handily. Democrats can only impeach in the House if they lose no more than 16 votes, assuming that if this is a party line, no Republicans vote for impeachment. Because if Democrats can't impeach him in the House, then regardless of what comes out in these hearings, this is a political disaster. So I'm looking at those 31 districts, those 31 kind of vulnerable Democrats and saying, what are you going to do? How are you viewing the testimony in these hearings?
Yeah, I mean, it is a partisan issue, and you know, everyone is going to view what happened yesterday, I think, through that partisan lens, unfortunately. What I saw yesterday was pretty devastating testimony for the president. I mean, basically, we had a witness whose testimony supported the idea that the president committed extortion, that he conditioned aid with the Ukraine on the Ukraine conducting a political investigation into a political adversary. You know, I think that fact should unite Americans. I mean, we should be united in the idea that, you know, you shouldn't be asking for foreign interference in a U.S. election. You shouldn't be asking a foreign government to investigate a U.S. citizen. But of course, there's partisan politics that are involved here. And so sort of we'll see what happens. I think looking forward, you know, we're going to have people who had more direct conversations with the president testify, like Ambassador Sondland. And I think that's going to be really, you know, crucial to how successful this impeachment inquiry is. At this point, given sort of the public statements by most Democrats, it seems as though the caucus is pretty united against the for the idea of proceeding with the inquiry. We'll see sort of what happens when you actually get to the vote. My prediction has been for a while that he's going to get impeached and then this is going to go to the trial. But, you know, I guess we'll see sort of what happens. So far, I think it was a really bad day for the president if he thinks that that's not going to happen.
Just the I think the basic question here, right? First day of testimony and what will be quite an extensive process. I mean, do either of you think that the Democrats did what they need to do here to sort of begin building the case, to lay the groundwork that they're going to need to lay to really try and shift public opinion on this?
I think this is a classic ink blot test, okay? Coming out of that hearing, Democrats said that they thought they got what they needed out of it. They're building – this is the first building block of a case that they're going to prosecute against the president. And Republicans felt like it was a win for them because the diplomat yesterday admitted that he didn't have firsthand knowledge. He hadn't talked with the president. He wasn't on the phone call in question. So, you know, is this hearsay? So both sides are looking at this saying it's a win. I'm looking – and I suspect, by the way, that the American people are looking at it and shrugging their shoulders because your typical person isn't watching the hearing and is only paying so much attention. So look, let's see next week when you start to have people come and testify who are – who have actual firsthand knowledge, who were on the phone call, including the staffer of that diplomat. I think that's where you start to see whether this is going to be – compelling or fall flat.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, to Matt's point, I mean, I think a lot of the Republican response yesterday has been focused a lot on objections to the process. That's been kind of the response in the, over the last few weeks. And then also, of course, saying that, you know, basically all we have is hearsay at this point. But we will have, you know, people who have more direct knowledge testifying. So that hearsay you know, our argument, I think, goes away. And then and the process question, I think, goes to a larger point, though, because the Republicans still haven't really addressed the actual facts here on whether the president was right or wrong to do what he did with the Ukraine. And so to me, I think focusing on the process is pretty telling because I think a lot of the elected officials don't want to actually talk about what he did and whether that's right or wrong.
Roy, less serious note on this. Probably, I think, inarguably, the quirkiest member of Arizona's congressional delegation, Representative Paul Gosar, had a series of tweets yesterday which added up to something related to Jeffrey Epstein and whether he killed himself or not. On a day when there's impeachment and the House is at some point going to have to vote on this, what do you make of Representative Gosar and his social media feed?
Well, quirky is one description of that. I mean, I don't know that, you know, I found that you see a lot of things on Twitter. You're like, is that real? And that was one of them. And it turns out it was real. So I don't know exactly what he was getting at. I don't know if he was trying to distract people, you know, based on what was going on yesterday in the impeachment hearing. You know, if for the life of me, I don't understand. I know that's a conservative district. I can't understand why there can't be a conservative representative who is not a little out there representing that district. So I don't know. Hopefully Republicans can find an alternative.
Matt?
I mean, look, can we, during these tumultuous times, can we not just all agree that Jeffrey Epstein didn't kill himself? I mean, come on.
All right. Oh, wow. Interesting way to end that. All right. Let's move on to our final topic, which is County Assessor Paul Peterson. Matt, let me start with you on this. So he is moving forward with some sort of defense. We're going to have on December 11th, county supervisors are going to take another step in this process. But the Peterson defense tactic has a lot to do with finding out whether there are skeletons or just more dirt on fellow elected officials. Even the county spokesman is involved in this. What do you think of this tactic?
Yeah, this is a classic burn the village, salt the fields tactic from the Peterson camp. And I think that, look, if the objective here is to have us stop talking about the trafficking that allegedly occurred on Peterson's behalf and instead start focusing on all these other things, all these other shiny objects, the attendance records of other county electeds and that sort of thing, then that was a win for the Peterson legal camp. And I think it just throws a lot of uncertainty into this issue going forward.
What's the end game here, you think? Like, he'll presumably be facing a trial on dozens of felony charges that, you know, will bring the topic back to those alleged trafficking charges. What is he hoping, I think, that he'll remain assessor while all that's going on?
I think so. I mean, this is all tied up together. I mean, increasingly in a high-profile investigation, you also think about the political aspect and sort of how this is being viewed by the media. And so he wants to keep his job, I think, because he wants to, again, perpetuate this idea that he didn't do anything wrong. So why would I lose the job if I didn't do anything wrong? I agree with everything that Matt said. I mean, I think it's a tactic here. I mean, obviously, if the facts are bad, you try to muddy the waters a bit, and I think that's what you're seeing from their camp. And so far, I have to say it's been pretty effective. I guess we'll see what the response is from the county.
I mean, look, can we just stop electing these people in these positions, okay? Why do we have an elected county assessor? Why do we have an elected state mine inspector, a state treasurer? I mean, I could go down the list. It's a pet peeve of mine. In fact, I think that there's about 50 different positions at the state and local level that we don't need. These should not be elected positions. And if they weren't elected positions, we wouldn't be in a pickle like this.
Well, Roy, final 30 seconds. It might make it interesting. People might pay even more attention to a gubernatorial election because then they'll say, oh, this governor is going to get to appoint a lot of these people, too. Do I actually like this candidate, male or female?
Yeah, I mean, in a gesture of bipartisanship, I completely agree, actually, with
that. that's twice this morning.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of positions that I think probably shouldn't be elected. They should be appointed. And to your point, I mean, if the importance of those positions are apparent to the public, then it should be part of the debate of the person who's running for office who will appoint them. And so if it's the governor that would eventually do that, and we care about who they're going to, you know, appoint to be assessor or treasurer or something, then that would be part of the debate.
Attorney and former congressional staffer Roy Herrera, Matt Benson of Veritas. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a special Thursday edition of the NewsCap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's big stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at the show at kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening.